Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. This week on the HR Power Hour, our guest is Steve Gerlach. He's an employer benefits attorney and shareholder at the law firm of Bernstein Shore. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and today we're talking with Steve Gerlach. He is the shareholder and employee benefits attorney for Bernstein Shore. Hello, Steve. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Dave. Good to see you.
Hey, good to see you. I'm assuming a few things have changed in the Affordable Care Act since the last time we talked, which was, probably about 8-9 months ago. As we head into 2016, tell me a few of the things that employers have to think about right now as they head into the remaining part of this year.
Absolutely. One of the things that employers are going to need to bear in mind is if they were relying on any of the delays in implementation, that those will be expiring this year. For example, that small employer between 50 and 99 exemption to the employer mandate, that's going to be running out with the end of their 2015 plan year, whenever that ends. So for some, that means that they've got to comply with the employer mandate as of January 1, 2016. For others, it might be July or April or October, whenever their new plan year starts up. But at that point, then it's full compliance from there on out, and we're not seeing any more delays come down the pike.
So when you say no more delays down the pike, so when an employee is looking at, I've been waiting, holding off, doing all the things that I know that they've said it might be delayed, things could happen. We're absolutely 100% sure now there are not going to be any more delays.
On the pay or play penalties, I think the only chance we have at further delay is the 2016 elections. And I would not hang my hat on that at this point. I don't see another delay coming from the IRS or coming from the Obama administration. We would know by now if we were going to see that. And in 2014, the last bit of delay, or what we call transition relief, it was passed in the final regulations. So we expect that.
So we're moving forward.
Yeah.
Period.
Exactly.
Now, one of the other things that has been on the radar but has been delayed is the Cadillac tax part of the Affordable Care Act. Do we see any notion as to when that actually might be moving forward, or is there anything we need to prepare for now in preparation for that later?
One of the great things about the delay is that it allows folks, even folks who have longer-term agreements, to not have to plan for it in the current environment. So what I mean by that is that employers who were in, say, collective bargaining agreements with their workforce, with the unions, oftentimes those will last 2 or 3 years, and they were in the position of having to think about, okay, how do we plan for this Cadillac tax in the context of the negotiations that we're having now that are going to affect the documents, the governing documents, 3 years out. And the guidance that we have from the IRS on the Cadillac tax, although they have come a long way, it's still not there yet. There's still a lot of empty spaces to fill, a lot of things unknown. And so I think the delay on the Cadillac tax was a good idea. Frankly, I don't know if it'll ever be implemented or transformed or changed, or who knows at this point. That's now 4 years in the future.
Okay. All right. So we know it's here. We know it's here to stay. So as employers start thinking about the best way to protect themselves from the cost factor of these, what are some of the things that they can look for to prevent from penalties, right? Because one of the things, as we all know, is that employers want to do the right thing, but there is an awful lot of administration
with the Affordable Care Act. Yeah. There just is. I mean, we were just down at talking to Cross Insurance, one of a very large benefits brokers here in not only Maine but in the Northeast. And they were talking about the onerous regulations that have really been put on this year that are now going into place. What are some of the things you're saying to them? Can they cut anywhere in any corner? Do they have to do it exactly? I know I'm trying to help employers here, Steve, and you're smiling. I get it. So tell me your thoughts.
Sure. A lot of what this is, from my perspective, is an employer taking measures to protect themselves. The short answer, there's not a short answer to your question, but I'm going to try.
Okay.
For example, in my view, for the next, let's pick a number, let's say 4, maybe 5 years, the information going into the system and the Affordable Care Act employer mandate system, compliance regulatory system, is going to be flawed. It's going to take some time to work the bugs out. And as a tax attorney, I view this through a particular lens where the IRS, the way they typically proceed in matters is that they will find an issue with an employer and they will send that employer a notice and say, you have 30 days to respond to this notice. We found X, Y, and Z. So in ACA terms, we found that this employees A, B, and C, all of them went to the healthcare exchange. They got coverage and they qualified for a tax credit. And that means that you're probably subject to a penalty. So we're going to assess that penalty. So it's kind of a shoot first, ask questions later approach.
Yeah.
And so the IRS assesses the penalty. Then the burden in legalese, the burden shifts onto the employer. It's literally the employer's burden to show that they in fact did what they were supposed to do. And so we look at documentation. So the kinds of things that we want to look at, we want to see that an employer made an offer of coverage to someone who was under the ACA qualified for that offer of coverage. Now, as a practical matter, what is that? That's a box checked and a signature on a form on annual enrollment every year.
Right.
The harder part is identifying in ACA terms, at least sometimes, who the full-time employees are. You take an employer like a bank or another that has typically a very stable workforce. Folks know when they're working, you know, a year in advance. You can predict with relative certainty where that teller is going to be and what they're going to be doing. Those folks may be less of a problem. They're also very used to being regulated, and so they kind of just ask the right questions. And you compare that with someone who runs a hotel, someone who runs a restaurant, seasonal business, high turnover. The ACA is a real challenge for these folks. And I want to emphasize that there's really not a shortcut, that they need to be documenting what they're doing to determine who's a full-time employee and to show that they are offering coverage to them.
You know, as I think as we're heading into the summer, dare I say that now that we're in March, but the reality is, as we head into the summer, seasonal employers that really gear up for summer activities, parks, camps, recreational facilities, even in the fall when we're doing picking, right? We're picking crops, we're picking different things, and it could be a 2-week season, 3-week season, different things. Yeah. What are some of the things they need to look at as to whether or not they have to be really worried about the Affordable Care Act from a seasonal perspective? Are there strict set guidelines to that?
There are some, yeah.
I love how you say some, yes. Some, not all, yes. It's very definitive, no, some.
There are some definitive guidelines.
Some, yeah, keyword, some. Okay.
So. You did know I'm an attorney, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, okay, so right. It depends is the key word that you always say. Well, it depends. Yes, I understand.
So what we can do is we can identify what the landmarks are, what those definite landmarks are, and then kind of work from there. The first question that I would ask is, with respect to seasonal employees, is there are a lot of folks in the hospitality industry and other seasonal industries, agriculture, that they've maybe have fewer than 50 year-round full-time employees, some cases four or five. And they get a huge seasonal bump in employment. And the very difficult but preliminary question to this is, for ACA purposes, are they a large employer? Do they hit that 50-plus mark that's going to require them to comply with the employer mandate? And that's a hard count to make. There's a very precise carve-out, so this is one of those landmarks. Yep. There's a precise carve-out that says that if your workforce is over 50 for fewer than 4 months out of the year, and the reason for that is because of a bump in seasonal employees, then you don't have to count those seasonal employees. So, but now here come the catches. Number one, what's a seasonal employee? Hmm. So pretty easy stuff if you're looking at agriculture. I'm going to take something on the, so because the berries are only there to be picked, the apples are only there to be picked for a certain season during the year. It's the classic definition.
Right. Simple.
You take, on the other hand, you take a bank teller, a person home from college working at bank tellering over the summer is not a seasonal employee because bank tellering goes on year round. It's there to be done all year round. The trickier part comes in where the IRS said that for the purposes of enforcing the ACA, employees who work during the holiday season and then are laid off, in most cases will qualify as seasonal employees. And then they added one little sentence in their guidance that gave us some flexibility, but not a whole lot of definition, and that is that unreasonable applications of this rule. So I raised the question, what about a bus company that has a big seasonal bump, say, in the summer and then another bump in the leaf peeper season? Well, that seems to me to compare pretty easily with the holiday season and the retail folks. You know, so my usual approach on that is if we can put a straight face on this thing that this is like a retail person working in the holiday season, then we can count them as a seasonal employee. But then the next trick to it is that 120 days. And most of the hospitality employers around here are, the season isn't 120 days long.
That's
it's
right.
not 4 months
That's
long. Right. It's 5 months. It's 6 months. It's 7 months, and that makes it harder to pull that kind of thing off. But it's a question that is absolutely worth looking at, and it's the preliminary question for a lot of hospitality employers around here.
We're talking with Steve Gruwek, a benefits attorney, employer benefits attorney for Bernstein Shure. You know, and we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. The other part that comes up is interns.
Hmm.
Right? So yeah. We're heading into what I call intern season, a lot like temp season, where all the kids are coming out of school and they all want to work, and employers want them all to work for free, which, of course, we know they can't or shouldn't, or you have to go through a huge hurdle. Mm-hmm. And I have the basic rule of thumb, yes, you can bring them on for free as long as they impair your business and make you less money than they can work for free. Great. It's a good term. Am I wrong with my analysis, Steve? I know you're laughing, but that's how my analysis is. If they hurt your business and they make you less money during that time, then they can be free. any analysts?
Well, some employers pay folks to do that for them.
There's truth to that. There is.
Yeah, it's actually, from an ACA perspective, it's not really much different. The analysis isn't much different. If they're an employee for other purposes, if the Fair Labor Standards Act or the tax withholding purposes, that person is treated as an employee, then we have to treat them as an employee under the ACA as well. And that means that they get measured. Do they work 30 hours a week? How long are they working 30 hours a week?
We're talking with Steve Gruwek from the employment law firm of Bernstein Shure. He's a shareholder and employer benefits attorney. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back. If you're responsible for hiring and firing,
You know, it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Hi, this is Carfax. You already say, show me the Carfax. But now you can say, show me millions of used cars for sale at the all-new Carfax.com, where now you can search with the power of Carfax. Want cars with no accidents reported? You got them. Used cars that are well-maintained? You can find those too. Even one-owner cars are just a click away. Plus, we're the only site where you get a free Carfax report with every car for sale. So, find the cars you want, avoid the ones you don't. Start your used car search at Carfax.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. Today we're talking with the one, the only, Steve Gerlach, benefits attorney for Bernstein Shore and shareholder, and just an all-around nice guy.
Thanks, Dave.
Yes, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. Hey, we're talking about the Affordable Care Act. We're having, ladies and gentlemen, fun talking about the Affordable Care Act. I realize that those two words and that sentence is an oxymoron, but in this particular case, we are having fun talking about it.
Absolutely.
So one of the questions that has come up has to do with senior executive compensation. And so for listeners out there, sometimes when you have a CEO or some of the C-suite level or even boards, they have some compensation that have a contract, and they may get additional benefits, additional richer packages because of certain things that are happening in their environment or their because of who they are and the experience they bring in. Anyways, we want the best talent, right? So how does that affect the Council on the Affordable Care Act? Does it affect it in any way? Does it hurt a company? Do they have to report it differently? How does that work?
Sure. A couple of thoughts on that. The first one is that is the non-discrimination rules under the ACA. And that's probably the most important piece to look at. By way of background, historically, self-insured plans, health plans, have been required to follow certain non-discrimination rules. The short version of this is that the participation and the benefits under a self-insured health plan are required to not favor the highly compensated. What happened with the ACA is that Congress decided that that's a good rule to apply to insured plans as well. And so that was passed with the ACA, and it was supposed to come into effect in 2011. However, the IRS kind of put the brakes on and said, we've got a lot on our plate right now. We need to issue some regulations on how this is going to work, and we're not there yet. And so we're basically in a holding pattern on this since 2011. The IRS did say that any future guidance on it would give at least 6 months transition time and would only be effective looking forward prospectively. So with that in mind, when thinking about an executive and negotiating a separation arrangement with an executive where you might be looking out for 3 or 5 or 7 years, one thing to bear in mind will be, is the law going to change in that period of time? And the answer is probably yes with respect to the health plans. And so one thing to consider in working through that contract is okay, if the law changes, what are we going to do? Or are we just simply going to avoid this? We're not going to pay for. So a very typical arrangement might be we'll pay your health insurance for the next 5 years until you qualify for Medicare, something like that. And from the employer's perspective, do we want to do that and just simply change it if the law changes, or do we just avoid it altogether and not do that this time around and perhaps compensate that executive in another way?
So when you're talking about leveling, different levels, different plans for different employee levels, mm-hmm. Some employers offer multiple options, mm-hmm. right? There's nothing that says that there has to be a balance of leveling. In other words, so let's say you offer a lower level plan and a higher level plan, and a majority of the employees take the lower level plan, but only senior executives happen to take the higher offering. Mm-hmm. There's no problem with that. There's nothing in terms of a what I would call a leveling factor across the board because it's choice.
Not necessarily. And we need to, again, we're looking for the guidance from the IRS on this. In some non-discrimination sets of non-discrimination rules that we have, so we have them for self-insured plans, we have them for retirement plans, there's a number of places in which the IRS has non-discrimination rules. Sometimes the rules look specifically at actual participation, and we don't know the answer to that yet with respect to the ACA.
So it could be an issue, but today it isn't because there's no rules that specifically tell you anything at this point.
Well, the one concern that your comment raised for me was, yes, you can offer any number of plans, and many employers do. In order to avoid penalties, however, under the ACA, one of those plans has to meet the ACA affordability rules. So, and the kind of general statement of that is that the employee's portion of the premium for self-only coverage can't exceed, I think the number is 9.66 now, percent of the employee's household income. Most employers rely on a safe harbor, either W-2 income or the rate of pay safe harbor, which is a calculation to get there.
Okay. All right. So that answers some basic questions. So not completely, because we don't know the answer completely mm-hmm. yet, but it certainly is something. Because I know a lot of employees, well, I'm offering plans. It's not my decision which one they choose. Mm-hmm. But I guess you actually have to kind of look at that, because is it affordable? Mm-hmm. Are both options affordable to them?
Actually, I'm going to jump in there. An employer is only required to offer one plan that meets the affordability requirements. So in that case, you can, or under that regulation, you can offer two tiers, and so long as one of them meets those.
As long as one meets, yeah, you're fine.
You're good.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's great. All right. Yeah. So there's clarity on that. Great. All right. So I'm going to take it up another little notch on this in terms of it. So an employer decides, I don't want to offer health care.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've decided I've had enough. I just can't do it anymore. I'm doing that. I'm going to give them an amount of money to go buy on the open market, on the exchange, mm-hmm. right? And I'm going to give you X number of dollars mm-hmm. to go do that. Talk to me about the pitfalls to that idea.
Sure.
Talk to me about the challenges. Tell me about the benefits. I mean, give me the whole realm around that, because there's a lot of talk about that again. And I hadn't heard that for a little while. I remember when it all came out, everybody said, oh, we're going to dump our plans. Well, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
Well, most people stayed with a plan. But there is some talk about, because of all the onerous, and we're going to talk about the reporting shortly here,
mm-hmm.
the employers are starting to say, if I have to hire 2-3 people just to deal with reporting, I've really about had enough of this nonsense.
Sure.
And that's real. Mm-hmm. They do have to hire people to do the reporting or hire an outsource company to help with that. So talk about that a little bit.
Okay. The one thing I want to be very clear about, because the IRS has been very clear about it, is any arrangement whereby an employer is paying an employee or giving an employee money to pay premiums for individual coverage, that is now against the law. And we need to be really clear about that. Okay? An employer can have $100 per day per person penalties assessed against him. That's $36,500 a year per employee for doing that kind of arrangement. And it doesn't matter whether you do it pre-tax or post-tax. And that came down. There was some original guidance that came out in 2013. It's IRS Notice 2013-54. I have it on my nightstand.
I'm sure it's guaranteed to put you right to sleep.
And then there was some ambiguity around that. There were a lot of questions around it, and the IRS issued another notice in 2015. It's Notice 2015-17, another one that's on my nightstand. And that one was very specific. It said, if you do this, you will be penalized $100 per day per employee, per employee affected, excuse me. And so I just wanted to kind of come out of the box with that, because that's a big deal.
Absolutely.
And it's in an area, it's a strategy that has been specifically ruled to be okay by the IRS since 1961. But in the context of the ACA, it's basically a reversal. So starting there, then kind of working back to your question about dropping coverage. I have seen folks considering dropping coverage. I have seen that. Not many actually do, for the reasons that you kind of stated. They want to attract the right people to their workforce. But some are considering it. And I think it's a fairly, you know, if a person's willing or an employer is willing to consider paying the shared responsibility payment, I'm sorry, the penalties, yeah. For that, it's $2,000 up to $2,100 now, $2,100 ahead per year. We won't go into the details of the calculation, but it's even it's less expensive than paying for the coverage.
No question. That's less, why they're being honest about it. That's what they're looking at.
Yeah, and less expensive than hiring two or three people to handle the reporting and administration. And so there are folks that are looking at that. Bear in mind, or they should bear in mind, that penalty is not tax deductible like an employee benefit would be.
Right.
So.
Right. How about health savings accounts? Mm-hmm. Whether an employer just decides to put money into a health savings account for them versus actually helping them with the health savings account itself. Can that be done? In other words, an employer just giving money to go into your health savings account rather than giving you actually premium for the plan itself.
I'm going to flesh out your question a little bit. So does the employee then have an individual coverage?
Correct. Let's say I'm going to go to the individual market,
mm-hmm.
getting a health savings plan, which there are available, obviously, as you know.
Yeah.
And then my employer is simply going to put money in my health savings account.
Yeah.
Rather than actually contribute to the actual plan itself or contributing to the health savings account itself.
Sure. So a couple of landmarks to be aware of with that. The first one is the rule that I just spoke about, prohibiting making contributions to an individual plan, prohibiting an employer from helping the employee pay the premiums on an individual plan. As I read that guidance, I read it very precisely to say an employer can't help an employee pay premiums on an individual plan. HSA contributions are not premiums, and they can't be used to pay premiums. So a precise reading of that, I think, says maybe that's okay. I want to take a step back from that, however, and say, are we just simply looking for the next loophole that the IRS is going to close? And I don't want to put employers in a position like that, at least not with their eyes closed. And so I have an open question about that. It really becomes a risk analysis at that point. The other thing to bear in mind, I'm aware of some employers that have tried to, small employers that are not subject to the employer mandate who have done this. We're not doing our own group plan anymore. Go forth, get your own individual plans, and we're going to give you all a raise. That's perfectly legal. Can't tie it to premium payments, can't make it a reimbursement, but you can give folks a raise. In the context of HSA, the employer should be aware that there are comparability rules that are basically kind of non-discrimination rules. The amounts going into those HSAs have to be either the same amount of money, the same dollar amount, or the same percentage of comp in order to comply.
We're talking with Steve Gerlach. He's an employer benefits attorney with Bernstein Sure and a shareholder. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
Running a company can feel like you're surrounded. A key person quits. A big project presents itself. You need good people fast. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Our contract staffing service will fill a position or find the right talent for a short-term project. Hundreds of companies choose us because we deliver people that fit. Career Management Associates, your contract staffing solution. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Because you've booked with Booking.com, you, freedom lover, are on the road and carefree. You're not worried that dealership billboards spoil beautiful views or that the fresh, cool breeze gives you a mouthful of fumes. No, because you know in just a few more miles, you'll be free to rock around in the perfect Booking hotel, treehouse, or rustic cottage of your dreams. Thanks to Planet Earth's number one accommodation site, Booking.com. Booking.yeah!
Man, do I love card night. You ready, boys? You got a king?
Go, Fish Dad!
Oh, come on! This is WWE superstar Titus O'Neil. The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Learn more at 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov.
Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
We're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com. And today we're talking about the Affordable Care Act with attorney, employer benefits attorney, Steve Gerlach from Bernstein Shore. Steve, we've talked a little bit about the regulations, talked a little bit about employers and what they have to look at. We've talked about some ways that employers have to start thinking about how they should handle it. But one of the things that is big for this year, and I don't care who you talk about, this is the big thing, it's the reporting issue. And the fact that there is so much reporting that is happening that people are and companies are actually starting to hire people just to handle the workload. Or they're trying to outsource it, of course, to handle this workload. I'm not sure that's what they initially thought it would be, but boy, it really is the way it is. We've talked about why it's important. Tell me about what you see as employers need to really make sure that they're focusing on so they don't get in trouble.
Sure. And I agree with you. The market is still sorting out the reporting piece of it. I'm seeing a lot of activity in payroll providers because that's kind of where that data that needs to be reported is being held. But I'm also seeing benefits managers and in some cases benefits brokers stepping up and assisting with the reporting and so forth. A couple of major points on the reporting. First of all, we did get a little bit of relief from the reporting deadlines, and I want to just get them out there. The reporting deadlines to get the 1095Cs, and we'll talk about what the forms are in just a moment, but the deadline to get the 1095Cs to employees is now March 31st. So that's coming right up. There's alongside of that, there's been some relief for individuals because at one point they were to rely on those in filing their own tax returns, much like they do the W-2s. For this 1 year only, essentially employees aren't required they're not required to go back and change their tax forms. So March 31st is that deadline. Then there's the May 31st deadline for filing the 1095Cs and 1094Cs with the IRS. That's the paper filing deadline. The electronic filing deadline is June 30th. Okay, so just want to get those out there because timing is real important. As you've noted, folks are still trying to wrap their arms about around the requirements, hiring people, outsourcing, that kind of thing. All of that takes time. I have seen where certain of these outsourced companies, be they payroll or software companies or whatever, literally not taking any new clients because they're so busy with this. So sooner rather than later, if you haven't done this already.
What if somebody says, well, you know, I'm just not going to meet my deadline. It's just not going to happen. You know, I've tried my payroll company and they're full. Mm-hmm. I've gone to broker. They can't help this. You know, I can't hire somebody with this knowledge. They don't, you know, I don't really understand. Mm-hmm. What's the penalty on that?
So it's I mean, think of it as any other tax return. There are penalties and interest associated with that. If you let it go completely, essentially, there's no statute of limitations on a failure to file. So the IRS can come back on it. I don't have a specific number for you. It's going to depend on the amount of tax that is owed. And
so when you're filing a tax, sometimes you can defer filing, mm-hmm. you know, 6 months or yeah. a year. Can you do that with this?
Not this time around. The IRS was very clear that these extended deadlines apply to everyone and that, at least so far, that's it. There may be something coming up down the pike for 2017 where you can do an extended, an extended deadline. But we haven't seen that yet.
Okay. Well, it's just a question because obviously we know people running in with their taxes on the last day.
Yeah.
Or the day after the last day. Right. Okay. For the extension. I'm sure you've never seen that before. Yeah.
Never,
yeah.
Dave.
Never. No, I know. I talked to my accountant and he always says, yeah, let's, that day, people just walk in with shoeboxes of receipts and they go, hey, I need to do my taxes today. Mm. It's the 15th. And he just looks at them and smiles and go, oh, my. Right? It's how it is. It's how it is out there. All right. So what other reporting factors are important for, let's talk about the form specifically.
Sure.
So, again, I don't know all the numbers, so mm-hmm. I'll let you do that. Yeah. Tell me and tell the audience a little bit about what each form specifically does and how it's important to make sure it's done right.
Okay. The reporting requirements break down, for our purposes, they break down into two requirements. One requirement is that of the large employer, and the other requirement is that of insurer. And I'll set aside the insurer for a moment and talk about the requirements for the large employer. The first thing, as we talked about earlier, is determining if you're a large employer. If you are 50-plus full-time equivalents, then you're a large employer and you have to do this filing. By the way, there's no additional relief for a plan with 50 to 99 employees. It's the filing deadlines are the same for everybody who is a large employer. So employers, all employers 50 plus are required to make this filing. That is the 1095C and the 1094C. I list them backwards because the 1095C is really the hard one. The 1094C is basically the cover letter. So I'm going to come back to those in a moment because I want to mention briefly the insurer side. These are forms 1095B and 1094B. For insured health plans, the insurance company is going to file those. However, if an employer is self-insured, they either have to fill out Part 3 on the 1095C, or if they're under 50, they're actually filling out and doing the 1095B and 1094Bs as if they were an insurance company. So moving back now to the rules for the employer, on the employer side, the 1095C, in my view, is a difficult form. It's not a form to be taken lightly. You have to understand how the overall employer mandate works in order to fill it out. You can't just, it's not intuitive. You have to know the rules before you come at it. And then there's about 20-something codes that you have to learn and kind of understand how they fit in the whole scheme in order to fill them out. But you're reporting that you offered coverage or didn't offer coverage to employees. You're reporting what the cost of that coverage is, and you're reporting on which, if any, transition relief or safe harbors you're relying on in that coverage. Sounds fairly straightforward until you start looking at the codes. My recommendation is, and has been for several months, is that an employer has to, number one, you have to assign this to somebody. You have to make somebody the reporting guru. It's going to be their responsibility. And then that person has to sit down and start coding. They have to look at each month, and they can do it just a trial run, but they have to start looking at their workforce in order to really understand how this works. It's not, like I say, it's not intuitive.
So one other part that I wanted to bring up in this segment is for owners that have two companies, and maybe each company has 26 employees each, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
And so I know, and we've talked about on the show before, that there's this co-ownership requirement, so they would meet the 51. Do they need to fill out separate forms mm-hmm. for each company, even though that's only 26, or how does that work?
Sure. Couple of comments. Kind of stepping back just a little bit, the example you gave was an easy one, where the same person owns two companies. The same one individual owns two companies. The rules you're referring to, though, the controlled group rules, are very complicated. And so what they address is the question of whether or not, for the purposes of ACA reporting, whether for the purposes of determining whether you're a large employer, whether or not the companies have to be counted together. And so a more difficult scenario is where multiple parties own the companies and the ownership overlaps, but not completely. And there's a whole series of rules and calculations that go into determining that. So I guess I would just simply start by, if that's an open question, that needs to be looked at as a preliminary matter. Once you're inside, once you've made that determination that you're a large employer, then yes, the separate companies the separate companies are responsible or can be made responsible for their own compliance.
So it's probably the best way to report it rather than joint reporting of the two companies together.
Yeah, I mean, they will have to report separately. You can, in some instances, report with a kind of a master transmittal sheet, the 1094C. I'll leave that to folks to sort of decide how they want to do it. Some of it depends. I mean, a lot of affiliated companies will have one group health plan for the whole thing because it tends to get them better prices if they negotiate on more participants. So in that case, it may be more simple to do it that way.
We're talking with Steve Gerlach. He's a shareholder and employer benefits attorney for Bernstein Sure. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, and we will be right back.
If you're responsible for hiring and firing, you know it can be like a roulette wheel. If your new hire turns out to be a bad hire, well, all you've lost is time and money. Hello, I'm David Chulo of Career Management Associates. Don't gamble with your hiring. We have a better solution. We've helped hundreds of companies like yours find the right talent, and we guarantee it. Career Management Associates delivers people that fit. Go to cmacareer.com.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Guys, when you buy your clothes at DXL, you look good. But you feel like a rock star. So if you want to look and feel like a You'll find all the brands you love, waist size 38 and up, all in one awesome store. DXL, you're looking good. Right now, Harbor Bay long sleeve tees are just $29.99 each when you buy two or more.
They were a marching band with a plan to steal their rival mascot's costume. Stealth would be critical. I said stealth was critical. They searched each room until there it was, the precious mascot in a glass case. They ran toward the exit when suddenly the theft was covered thanks to a farmer's agent. Marching Bandits, May 4th, 2015. Talk to farmers. We know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two.
We are farmers. Bum, 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 bum.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAKorea.com. And today we're talking with Steve Gerlach. He's an employer benefits attorney and shareholder at Bernstein Shearer. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act. And yes, we're having a fun time doing it, Steve. Yes, we are. I know people out there are going, this has been, I'm sure, look, let's be honest. Employers, if you've been listening, you really got some really good takeaways here. To make sure that you are compliant, to make sure that you're doing it right. Let's acknowledge that there's a lot of work ahead of you from a reporting standpoint if you're over 50 full-time employees. But the reality is that you want to do it right. You want to save from having the penalties. All right, so we've talked about what's going on. Let's look at the future. Let's look at the rest of 2016. Let's even speculate 2017, though I recognize that the election cycle will have a big factor in that. But in this particular, let's speculate the rest of the year into 2017. What do employers need to think about going forward? What do they need to plan for, and what do you see happening?
Sure. Sure. I see a few things. First of all, I just want to underscore the importance this year of the reporting and getting on the reporting. As we've already discussed, it's not something you can put off until the last day. It's not going to work for you. So that being said, talk a little bit about what I'm seeing in the marketplace right now, trends that will likely continue into the future. Mentioned one of them, that the payroll companies are tending to take up the reporting requirements. An important piece of that for employers to notice is that both contractually and under IRS regulations, the fact that you've outsourced that reporting duty does not get you off the hook. In other words, if the reporting's wrong, it's still going to come back on the employer. And so someone at the employer is still going to have their eyes on this and make sure that they know that it's happening correctly. Another thing to look forward to may not be the right choice of words, but will likely start happening in the future is that employers will start receiving notices from the exchanges. So I've already started seeing that in the state of Connecticut. At least in theory, it should have started happening in other states as well as of January, but we're not seeing it yet. I think I'm speculating here, but I think it's just because Connecticut's got a state-run exchange and they're doing their own thing and they're on top of it that they're getting these out. But I can tell you what they look like. It says employee A has applied and received a tax credit on the healthcare exchange, and therefore you, employer, may be subject to penalties. And then it'll give you a deadline to respond, et cetera, et cetera. I think that in other states, Maine, New Hampshire, we can start looking for these to start coming out anytime now. A couple of things, as with any tax notices, the rule number one, don't ignore it. If you ignore it, it gets worse. It doesn't go away. And the IRS will just get more aggressive. And if you're documenting and if you're doing the kinds of things that you need to do to protect yourself, it may go away fairly quickly if you do respond. So respond to the notice, call trusted advisors, call counsel, make sure that you're doing what you need to do to protect yourself. And realize also it's very important to recognize that there are protections built into the system for any taxpayer that apply in these cases as well. You have rights to appeal, at least in theory. You have the right to go all the way up to the Supreme Court with it. A lot of steps in between, but importantly, you know, you are likely to go through several layers of IRS before getting there, and documentation is the thing that makes the IRS change their mind. It's documentation. So we start to see that. There's also a backstop to the notices coming from the exchange. What will happen is, and again, a little bit unsure of the timeline on this, but the IRS will actually do assessments as well on the back end, whether or not the exchange notices have gone out. At least that's what I expect will happen. They're not going to have, the IRS isn't going to have the information to do that for some time. They have to have the individual tax returns in. They have to have the 1095s and 1094s in. They have to have all of the reporting coming in from the exchanges. We're not likely to see something on this for another, I'd say, 6 months to a year. But at some point, those will start coming out as well. Other things to expect going forward. I know we kind of panned talking politically, but I think it is important to talk politically for just a moment anyhow. My advice is, here it is.
Ladies and gentlemen, listen live.
Free legal advice. My advice is don't wait for the law to change to comply with it. It's just, we've seen it so many times now, over 5 years. And some little pieces of it have gone away. Some little pieces of it have been delayed, but you don't know what and when until it's probably too late. So don't wait for Congress to change this next year. Don't know if it's going to happen. And in the interim, you could be hit with a lot of penalties.
Final thoughts.
Final thoughts. Just one, urgency. If you're not doing this, if you haven't wrapped your arms around the ACA as an employer, it's time to start.
You know, that sounds like really good, solid advice. And by the way, I want to congratulate you, as I'm sure most listeners in the local area know, you recently became the shareholder at Bernstein Sure, so congratulations.
Thanks very much.
Yes, it's great. You've been there quite a while, and I would say that it's well-deserved.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. We've been talking with Steve Gerlach, employer benefits attorney at Bernstein Sure and shareholder. We appreciate you being on the show, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
And now your HR tip of the week. Today, presented by Steve Gerlach, Bernstein Sure, employer benefits attorney and shareholder. Steve?
Thanks, Dave. One of the things that we're seeing now in the employee benefits arena is a real emphasis on wellness programs. The EEOC, who's the government agency responsible for enforcing at least part of wellness programs, has taken a very aggressive stance on many provisions in wellness programs that have to do with discrimination. And there are a number of cases out there. Some are going in favor of employers, some are going against employers. But for an employer that does sponsor a wellness program, and in particular for an employer that offers discounts or for participation or penalties for not participating, very important to look as the rules are changing.
And that's your HR tip of the week. Next week on the HR Power Hour, Deborah Weiss Ford, managing partner at the law firm of Jackson Lewis, will be back, and she'll be talking about retaliation claims in the workplace. That's on the next HR Power Hour. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 1310 a.m. or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.